Well, thank you all for coming out. It's really an honor to be with you, and really want to thank the A.M. Cotton Foundation and the Mosaic Rooms, and also very honored to have folks here from my wonderful publisher in the U.K., from Serpent's Tale, which is an amazing independent publishing house that's been putting out fantastic books for a very long time. And right away, when I initially wrote the book about Blackwater, they were the first people to show interest in it and have been with me ever since and have really been wonderful partners in this. So I'm really honored to work with the team from Serpent's Tale. We're living in an interesting moment right now in... There we go. We're living at an interesting moment right now in the world because you have a man as president of the United States in Barack Obama who is a constitutional law professor by trade, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, is a popular Democratic president who came into power after 8 years of what many people around the world consider to be the absolute worst presidency in American history, certainly on a foreign policy level. And this man who so many projected an image of transformation onto, they saw in him what they wanted to see when he was running for president, has actually expanded or intensified some of the very policies when it comes to U.S. national security policy, or what's called U.S. national security policy, has intensified some of the most egregious aspects of his predecessor's program. On Barack Obama's third day in office, he signed a series of executive orders that his administration portrayed as dismantling the Bush-era torture and abuse apparatus. He signed an order saying that he wanted to shut down the U.S. prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He signed an order that said that the United States was no longer going to engage in torture, and another that was intended to bring an end to the CIA's, what were called the CIA's black sites around the world. But in each of those promises that he made in the form of these executive orders, what we've seen is a continuation of the program. Guantanamo remains open. 27 people are on a hunger strike right now and being force-fed. The U.S. no longer officially uses tactics such as waterboarding, but continues to use the techniques laid out in the U.S. Army Field Manual in Appendix M that in many countries around the world, the tactics contained in that manual would be considered torture. The CIA no longer is running black sites in countries like Thailand or Poland. Instead, we're using other countries' secret prisons and their human rights abusing forces to hold and interrogate prisoners that the United States would have previously put in its own black sites or had interrogated directly by the CIA. I don't believe for a moment that if John McCain had won the election in 2008, that you would see polls indicating that 70% of self-identified liberals favor drone attacks, and that support for those drone strikes would drop only negligibly when the target in question was an American citizen. On the drone issue, Barack Obama has expanded those attacks exponentially from the Bush-era levels. In fact, it's become the tip of the spear of what he calls his counterterrorism policy. In Yemen and Somalia in particular, there has been a dramatic increase in the number of not only drone attacks, but in the case of Yemen, cruise missile strikes and covert raids. On September 30th, 2011, Barack Obama was faced with a decision as the Commander-in-Chief of the United States. And it was a decision that his administration had tried for years to rationalize legally, and that was the decision on whether or not to assassinate a United States citizen without even charging him with a crime. And the citizen that they were seeking to assassinate wasn't engaged in battle on a declared battlefield against American soldiers. For Obama, the decision had been made years before September 30th, 2011. He had said that I want Anwar al-Awlaki. He had even told his advisors that in the case of this American citizen, even if he was among women and children, that he didn't want that to rule out striking him. He wanted to be presented with the real-time information and make a decision once he had all of the facts. Had decided that he would even loosen the restrictions on the killing of civilians if it meant that they could definitively kill a man named Anwar al-Awlaki. Many of you probably have heard of Anwar al-Awlaki. He became infamous in 2009, and after Osama bin Laden was declared by the United States to be public enemy number one, after Osama bin Laden had been killed. And we've all seen, if you know who Anwar al-Awlaki is, the YouTube clip of him wearing a camouflage jacket in front of the black flag, calling for armed jihad against the United States, calling on young Muslims in the West to either conduct attacks in their home countries or to join the Mujahideen on the fronts of jihad in Somalia or Yemen, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. For many Americans, the fact that al-Awlaki appeared in these videos made it an easy decision. You have a man who's saying death to America, who's calling for attacks, who's praising attacks not only against U.S. soldiers but also against U.S. civilians, praising the attempts to blow up civilian airliners, in one case over Detroit, Michigan, on Christmas Day 2009. But what you seldom hear about Anwar al-Awlaki is how he became the man who you see in the YouTube video. What I would put forward is that Anwar al-Awlaki was a product of American foreign policy. He was a man who was transformed by Washington's own wars, by the rhetoric of the Bush era. I remembered seeing Anwar al-Awlaki on television soon after 9/11, because Anwar al-Awlaki was a very popular imam at a large mosque in Falls Church, Virginia. And he was on major U.S. corporate media outlets, on public television, on national public radio, profiled in the Washington Post, because what he was saying was something that I think a lot of Muslims in the United States were feeling in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. He was saying, we're against what happened in New York City and in Washington, D.C. We're against the flying of airplanes into buildings full of civilians, and we condemn that. In fact, Anwar al-Awlaki went so far as to say that the United States had a right to actually go into Afghanistan and to hunt down those responsible for the 9/11 attacks. He was a man who was helping large media organizations in the United States to make sense of the experience of many American Muslims in the U.S., condemning the 9/11 attacks, but then facing a reality where their communities were under attack, where there was bigotry and fear and hatred. The day after September 11th, a woman stumbled into al-Awlaki's mosque in Virginia after being beaten with a baseball bat. She was targeted in a hate crime because she was a Muslim. Muslim organizations and charities were being raided. Imams were being pulled into FBI offices and pressured to start informing on their congregations at their mosques. And al-Awlaki was simultaneously preaching against al-Qaeda, saying they had perverted the religion of Islam, and also condemning the hate attacks against Muslims in the United States by their own countrymen and by their own government. And I remembered seeing him because I tried to book him on a program when I was a radio producer at a show called Democracy Now! And he would never agree to come on our show, but I remembered him well because we were looking for people that reflected that complicated point of view and that position that so many Muslims were in at that time. So Anwar al-Awlaki was an American citizen whose father is still, to this day, a very well-respected figure inside of Yemen. His dad grew up in a place that didn't have a name. He grew up in the south of Yemen at a time that the country was not yet declared as a nation. He came to the United States as a Fulbright scholar in 1966 and studied at New Mexico State University. I got to know the al-Awlaki family well, including the female members of the family. Most stories that are done about the al-Awlakis just interviewed Dr. Nasser al-Awlaki. He speaks English well. He's a prominent citizen. They actually allowed me to have access to the entire al-Awlaki family, including the women of the family, which is very unusual. And they told me a very different part of this story about who the people that are involved with this story, who they really are, who they really were before they became caricatures of an evil al-Qaeda terrorist in a cave somewhere. So this family came to the United States in 1966, and in Dr. Nasser al-Awlaki's essay that he wrote when he was a Fulbright scholar, he said that he was captured by the progressive spirit of America and that he wanted to get an education in the United States so that he could return to Yemen to help deal with the water crisis in the country. Yemen may become the first country in the world to run out of water, and part of it has to do with the cultivation of the khat plant, which many men in the country chew, most men in the country chew, and some of it has to do with a fundamentally mismanaged state. So he comes to the United States in 1966, and Anwar al-Awlaki is born in 1971 at Las Cruces, New Mexico Hospital. And Nasser told me about how at the time in the United States you could pass out cigars in hospitals and smoke them. And he passed out cigars, said, "It's a boy." And there's all these photographs of this young kid being raised in the United States and going to the YMCA to go swimming. And he went to schools both in New Mexico and in the Twin Cities in Minnesota when Nasser was getting another degree there. There's a picture of a young Anwar al-Awlaki. I think he was in first or second grade, pointing at a globe and trying to find Yemen on the map. He went to Disneyland. When Anwar was just starting school, his father was offered a job back in Yemen, so they moved their young family back to Yemen, and they were part of the elite in Sana'a. Anwar al-Awlaki ended up going to an international school in both English and Arabic, where he attended classes with the children of the dictator, Ali Abdullah Saleh. In fact, he went to grade school, primary school, with some of the very men who later would work with the United States in an effort to try to kill him. He attends his school in Sana'a while his father is a government minister and builds up the Department of Agricultural Engineering at Sana'a University. And then he returns to the United States after high school. And he arrives in Denver, Colorado, just as the what was called the Gulf War was beginning in 1991, when the United States began attacking Iraq. And when he came back to the United States for college, he was not a particularly religious guy. He was going to follow in his father's footsteps, and he was going to study some form of engineering. His father very much wanted him to be an academic. He started going to some anti-war meetings, organizing against the 1991 war, and he started to become politicized, not radicalized, politicized. And he was invited to give a speech at a local mosque because he was a student organizer against the war. He goes to the mosque and gives a speech, and the imam says, "Well, you have a real gift. You should come back and spend more time with us." And he starts spending more and more time at the mosque, and eventually he decides that he wants to explore becoming an imam. And so he starts to shift his studies from the secular studies at the university to Islamic scholarship. And eventually he becomes an imam. And while he is an imam at a mosque in Denver, Colorado, his firstborn son, Abdulrahman, is born in 1995. And the al-Awlaki family moved around a bit. They ended up in San Diego, and the neighbors of the al-Awlakis, who were white Christians, talked about what a friendly family they were and how al-Awlaki's wife would cook them fish that Anwar himself had caught, and that they were all around great neighbors. And they seemed to be heading on a certain trajectory, with al-Awlaki as a religious figure, and an important one at that. And when September 11th happened, he was the imam at Dar al-Hijra Religious Center in Virginia, and the statements that he made on media are well documented on the internet. He was so respected in Washington at the time that he was invited by the Pentagon shortly after 9/11 to come and give a lecture on the state of Islam in the world. And he accepted that invitation and ended up going and speaking at the Pentagon. To give you a sense of how bad the intelligence was at the time at the Pentagon, among the sandwiches they served were bacon sandwiches. You invite an imam to the Pentagon and then serve bacon sandwiches. So al-Awlaki was this sort of respected member of American society at the time. But then the rhetoric starts to build up about invading Iraq, and Bush is saying we're on a crusade, and Guantanamo prison opens, and then you start to see the images of people in orange jumpsuits being shackled and taken halfway across the world after being picked up in Afghanistan, Pakistan, or elsewhere. And al-Awlaki decides that he doesn't want to be in the United States anymore, and so he comes to Britain, and he ends up giving a series of lectures here, and he travels across the country, and he's sort of flailing as a person. He doesn't quite know what he's doing. He's a much-in-demand speaker. He's not making money to support his family. Ultimately, he decides to return to Yemen. At this point, and I'm sure that there is at least someone in the room who remembers this period in his life, he was starting to become known as a modern imam who would weave in pop cultural references with the hadiths of the Prophet Muhammad or verses from the Quran, and began to become very popular among certain young, particularly young Muslims in Britain, in the United States, in India, Pakistan, elsewhere around the world. But on his personal life, he wasn't doing well. So he goes back to Yemen, where his family has a solid base, and he's looking into maybe getting involved in real estate or some other form of business. And then his recordings start popping up in investigations in the United States and Britain into alleged terrorist activity. And so al-Awlaki is on the U.S. government radar. And as they search who is this guy, they discover that he had been questioned repeatedly by the FBI because three of the 9/11 hijackers had attended services at his mosques. When he was investigated by the FBI, they determined that he had no connection to the 9/11 attacks. But when you put that together with sermons that are popping up in terror investigations, he became a subject of investigation of the U.S. government. I won't get into all of the details of it tonight, but in my book, I tell an interesting story, or what I think is an interesting story, about al-Awlaki's relationship with the FBI when he was in the U.S. I think it's possible that he had been cultivated as an asset by U.S. intelligence prior to 9/11, and that part of the reason he ended up leaving the United States was because he was under tremendous pressure to continue informing on his community. But I'll leave that for you to read if you're interested. So he goes back to Yemen and continues recording sermons, and then they're selling them around the world. In 2006, Anwar al-Awlaki is arrested in Yemen on trumped-up charges of intervening in a tribal dispute. And he's put in prison in Sana'a. And he's held for 18 months in solitary confinement, 17 months in solitary confinement, 18 months total in prison. And I reviewed his prison writings, and al-Awlaki believed very much that he was in prison because the United States government had told the Yemeni government to put him there. When the United Nations investigated his incarceration, they determined that it was extra legal and that the United States was, in fact, involved. I learned in the course of my reporting that it was John Negroponte, who at the time was the director of national intelligence in the United States, that told the Yemeni government, we want Anwar al-Awlaki kept in prison for 4 or 5 years so that people forget about him. That's how serious of a threat they viewed his words. At that time, there was no allegation that he was involved with any plots. It's that they wanted him to shut up. So they thought if we bury him in a prison in Yemen, people will forget about him and no one is going to care. While he's in prison, he's given a limited number of books. He thought that Shakespeare was an imperialist. He loved Dickens, would compare figures in the U.S. or Yemeni governments to Uriah Heep and other characters. You know, he did reviews of the prison food, but he also increasingly became radicalized and started to view himself as being at war with the United States, at war with a country that he perceived to be attacking his religion, not attacking nation states, but attacking an actual religion. And he comes out of prison, and this story throughout history is the same with so many political prisoners. He came out of prison a very changed man. And the internet became his mosque. And he starts recording his sermons and uploading them and posting blog posts. And some of it was dealing with questions as mundane as, is it proper to buy certain kinds of cheese as a Muslim from big grocery stores? And what the rules governing various eating habits if you're in Western countries, what those rules should be. And he developed a very vibrant comment community. But he also took on questions of, is suicide bombing permitted under the teachings of the Quran? Suicide or martyrdom was one of his essays. And he ultimately did come down on the side of that suicide bombing could be appropriate. So the United States is watching him. He's becoming more radical. He's becoming sharper in his critique of the United States, and he's becoming more popular and more influential around the world. In the middle of 2009, the head of Yemen's intelligence service, backed and supported by the United States, comes to Dr. Nasser al-Awlaki, Anwar al-Awlaki's father, and they say, you know, we are doing constant surveillance on your son, and if you don't convince him to come back into our prison, the Americans are going to kill him with a drone. This is before anyone has ever alleged that Anwar al-Awlaki was involved with anything except speech that the United States considered dangerous. And you can read his speeches for yourself and determine what you believe about them. But before I tell you the rest of the story, I want to say this. To me, the relevant question isn't who was Anwar al-Awlaki. The relevant question is who are we? Who are we as Americans, or who are we as people that claim to live in civilized societies that are models for the rest of the world? Because it's not how you treat law-abiding citizens that defines who you are as a society. It's not how you treat the popular. It's how you treat the poor and how you treat the most reprehensible of your citizens. And if there are some people for whom you think that the mob should go out and mete out justice with pitchforks and torches, then don't claim to be the shining city on the hill. This is more a story about who the American people are than it is about who Anwar al-Awlaki was. But his story becomes important because it sets a standard. How the United States treats its own people speaks volumes to how it views non-Americans around the world. So Anwar al-Awlaki, as of May of 2009, was already on the U.S. government radar, and there were threats that they were going to kill him. So he goes underground, and he moves to Shebwa province in the south of Yemen, where his family's ancestral roots are. And he continues his blogging from there. And the Yemeni government continues to put pressure on his father to go and convince Anwar to come back to Sana'a. Because in his tribal areas, the regime's security forces couldn't touch him. But in Sana'a, they could keep an eye on him. So Nasser al-Awlaki goes down to Shebwa and he says to his son, they're going to kill you if you don't come back. And Anwar says, what are you, an American agent now? I was born free, I'll die free. I'm not going to let the Americans tell me which way to position my bed at night. And that was the last time that Nasser al-Awlaki spoke to his son. Then in November 2009, A U.S. Army major named Nadal Hassan commits a massacre at the U.S. Army base in Fort Hood, Texas, and shoots more than a dozen of his fellow soldiers, wounds several other soldiers, and is paralyzed himself in the operation. It emerges in the media that Nadal Hassan had been emailing Anwar al-Awlaki, and the story became that Anwar al-Awlaki, who had contact with the 9/11 hijackers and is calling for jihad against the United States, had something to do with the Fort Hood shooting. Now, those emails have been declassified, and you can read them online. Nadal Hassan was basically like a stalker who was asking Anwar al-Awlaki to help him find a wife in Yemen, who was asking al-Awlaki if he could give him a $5,000 prize for being the greatest imam in the world, who wanted to host a essay contest in his name. And al-Awlaki was sort of like brushing him off and would say, give the money to the orphans, or, yeah, I'll keep an eye out for a brother for a wife in Yemen. It was some kind of a get away from me. But Nadal Hassan is an interesting guy. Nadal Hassan was an army psychiatrist who spent several years listening to the stories of American soldiers coming back from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he actually tried to take up the chain of command charges that his patients were war criminals. And nothing ever came about, you know, and there's some dubious ethics involved with that, or you could say that there are strong ethics, depending on how you look at it, with attempting to have people brought up on war crimes charges. But this man clearly was unhinged and deranged the day that he opens fire and kills all of these soldiers. Al-Awlaki, no evidence has emerged to suggest that al-Awlaki had something to do with the plot, but what we know is that the day after Nadal Hassan committed that massacre, Anwar al-Awlaki published a blog post saying Nadal Hassan is a hero and calling on other U.S. soldiers who were Muslim to commit similar attacks against U.S. soldiers on bases or off bases in the United States or in war zones abroad. And that sealed his fate. Whether he was involved with it or not became irrelevant because he was known to be praising it. The CIA shuts down his blog, and in December of 2009, the United States tries for the first time to kill Anwar al-Awlaki in a missile strike inside of Yemen. Now, this is the first year of the administration of Barack Obama. He comes into office as a president with absolutely no military experience. He had very limited foreign policy experience. He had a carefully and meticulously molded public persona on foreign policy that began in October of 2002 when he gave a speech against the Iraq war saying, I'm not opposed to all war, I'm opposed to dumb war, separating himself from pacifists or others on the left who are arguing against the Bush wars. He narrowed his critique to one specific war. And he had campaigned on a pledge not to end wars, but to intensify the war against specific terrorists, to ratchet up the war in Afghanistan, to rely more heavily on special operations forces. And so when he gets sworn into office, publicly you have a drama playing out where he's issuing executive orders and saying this era is over. And then privately, you have him pulling into the fold the most central and powerful figures in the U.S. Special Operations Forces community. He taps General Stanley McChrystal to be the head of the war in Afghanistan. McChrystal ran the Joint Special Operations Command, the most elite U.S. military force, for the duration of the Bush era. They basically functioned as Murder, Inc. in Iraq. The myth that General David Petraeus won the Iraq war, first of all, is ridiculous given what's happening in Iraq right now, the idea that anyone won that war. But second, the idea that the surge was the central factor in reducing the fighting in Iraq. It was that a twofold operation. JSOC was killing its way through every militant organization or resistance movement, or in some cases terrorist organizations in Iraq. Local cells would pop up. They would decapitate them. You also had the awakening councils where the U.S. was paying Iraqi tribesmen in the Sunni areas of western Iraq not to kill American soldiers. So Stanley McChrystal, who had run these operations, which often were done just with the coordination of Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, or Vice President Dick Cheney, this man becomes the leader of the war in Afghanistan. Admiral William McRaven, who was the commander of the Joint Special Operations Command, was a guy who was an original member of SEAL Team 6, spent most of his life operating in the shadows. He would have forward deployed on 9/11, but he had hurt his back in a parachuting accident in California. And so McRaven began his career on the political end of the kill machine by advising the National Security Council on how to develop their high-value targeting program, and understood very, very well by the time Obama came into office how the White House worked and how covert action around the world worked. He becomes one of Obama's most trusted advisors on the policy, not how to implement the policy, but on the policy itself. And very early on in Obama's administration, you have McChrystal, McRaven, and Petraeus, all serving as the senior advisors on the campaign that the president was then going to wage against what they said against terrorism around the world. So Obama comes into office, and Yemen is presented as the most serious and significant external threat facing the United States. JSOC and Petraeus come to President Obama with a plan to expand U.S. operations inside of Yemen. When Obama took office, there had been only one known U.S. strike in Yemen, and it was in November of 2002, a drone strike that happened. A U.S. citizen was killed in that strike, along with five or six others, but he wasn't believed to have been the intended target of the strike. So to return to the al-Awlaki part of this story, the U.S., under President Obama, starts bombing Yemen in December of 2009. They try to kill Anwar al-Awlaki at the end of 2009, and then over the next 2 years, we'll try to kill him more than a dozen times in drone attacks and other sorts of strikes. But the first time that President Obama authorized an attack against Yemen, it wasn't a drone strike and it wasn't aimed at al-Awlaki. They bombed a village called al-Majla on December 17, 2009. And the U.S. claimed that what was hit was an al-Qaeda training camp. And they claimed that the attack against the al-Qaeda training camp was conducted by Yemen's military forces, by Yemen's air forces. Yemen claimed responsibility for the strikes. They said they had killed 34 al-Qaeda terrorists and destroyed a training camp. The White House sent a letter of congratulations saying Yemen is a great partner in the war on terror. What we now know, for two reasons, what we now know is that that was an American cruise missile attack with cluster bombs. Cluster bombs are like flying landmines that shred human beings and animals into meat. I've seen the impact of them in Yugoslavia, and I've seen the impact of them in Afghanistan, and I've seen the impact of them in Yemen. And the reason we know that it was a U.S. strike and that it was a cruise missile attack is because a Yemeni journalist named Abdullah Haider Shaya went to al-Majla after that bombing, photographed the missile parts, sent them to human rights organizations who had them analyzed by weapons experts, and they determined that they were absolutely U.S. munitions, that Yemen wasn't in possession of them. They could trace them all the way back to General Dynamics and to the factories in which they were manufactured. He took these photos and he broadcast them around the world and he sent them to human rights organizations and he began speaking about how there was a new American bombing campaign inside of Yemen and that the people killed that day were not al-Qaeda terrorists but a Bedouin village. When I went to Yemen and investigated it, I obtained a list of the dead from the al-Majla attack. 14 of the 46 people killed were women and 21 were children. And lest you think someone sold me a bill of goods and handed me a list and doctored some names on it, we have the most graphic video you could imagine that was taken by survivors with their cell phones of body parts of infants being pulled from rubble and the flesh of goats and sheep intermingled with the flesh of human beings. And I went and I interviewed the survivors of this strike who are largely illiterate, extremely poor, rural people. I believe that the Yemeni government fed the United States intelligence that this was an al-Qaeda training camp, knowing full well that it was a tiny, small, poor Bedouin village because they thought no one will ever go there. Washington is pressuring us for results. We'll just give up this village and say it's an al-Qaeda training camp. And we know about that because of this one journalist. And that journalist was then abducted by Yemen security forces after blowing the whistle on this, savagely beaten in the headquarters of the political security organization in Yemen, and threatened that if he continued talking about the American bombing, that they were going to stick him back in prison. The night that he was released onto the street, he went straight to Al Jazeera's headquarters and went on the air and said, I have just been beaten by Yemen security forces for exposing the American missile attacks, and I will not be silenced. And he continued to report on it. And eventually, his house was raided by Yemen's American-backed counterterrorism unit. He was abducted and disappeared for 30 days. After 30 days, he was brought into a courtroom in a court that was set up specifically to prosecute journalists who had committed crimes against the Yemeni government, a court that has been condemned by every major human rights and media rights organization in the world. And he was brought into that court that day and put in a cage, like a monkey cage. And they charged him with being an al-Qaeda facilitator and of plotting to attack foreign embassies. The thing he was most guilty of was exposing the U.S. bombing of Yemen and having the audacity to interview members of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, whom the United States had deemed to be enemies. And when he was in that cage, he said, "This is what happens when you're a real journalist in Yemen. They put you in prison." So they sentenced Abdullah Haider Shaya to 5 years in prison. There was tremendous pressure from international and local human rights organizations to release him, pressure from the powerful tribes in Yemen to release him. The dictator of Yemen had very little choice at the end of the day. Because of all of the pressure, he decided he was going to pardon, not acquit, but pardon Abdullah Haider Shaya. And word leaks in the Yemeni media that he's going to do this. That day, the day that this story came out, that he was going to pardon him, Ali Abdullah Saleh gets a phone call from the White House. Not from some undersecretary of this or that, not from Hillary Clinton, but from Barack Obama himself. And Barack Obama told Ali Abdullah Saleh that the United States wanted Abdullah Haider Shaya kept in prison, and the pardon was ripped up. So you have a journalist who at this moment remains in prison in Yemen, 3 years after he was originally put there, because the constitutional law professor, American president, said we want him kept in prison. Among his other crimes was interviewing Anwar al-Awlaki. If you read his interviews with Anwar al-Awlaki, it is because of this journalist that we know that al-Awlaki praised the attempted underwear bomber, that we know that al-Awlaki had actually met with Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, this deranged young Nigerian guy who tried to blow up the airplane over Detroit on Christmas Day 2009. If you read his interviews, what you'll see is a more critical interview with al-Awlaki than most U.S. journalists ever have with a politician. He was doing his real job as a journalist. And you can check my facts on this all you want online, and you'll see that he asked him real questions about why would you praise an attack targeting a civilian airliner? You know, it's one thing to call for attacks against a military if you claim to be at war with them, but how do you justify praising an attempt to blow up a civilian airliner? He was asking him those kinds of questions, which I think any responsible journalist would be asking someone like al-Awlaki. But he gets put in prison for going and interviewing them and for exposing the new American air war in Yemen. So in January of 2010, we learn officially that Anwar al-Awlaki is in fact on the U.S. kill list, and that there are at least three Americans who have been targeted for assassination by the Obama administration. And the United States tries repeatedly to kill Anwar al-Awlaki. And they're trying to hunt him down and to find him, and they're trying to pay informants to give him up, and they're sending special operations teams into Yemen to hunt him down. They break into cars that they think are being used by al-Awlaki, or they put tracking devices on them, and they're on the manhunt. Then they're also trying the spy game. The CIA gets word that there's a Danish guy named Martin Storm, who is a former motorcycle gangster with a criminal record. And Martin Storm has come to the Danish intelligence service, the PET, and says, "I know Anwar al-Awlaki. I used to be friends with him when I was studying in Sana'a. And I think I can help you find him because I'm still in email touch with him." And the CIA ends up paying this guy $250,000 at least to help concoct a plot to find a bride, a wife, for Anwar al-Awlaki so that he can marry and live his life underground with a woman that he finds on the internet. And so he and al-Awlaki exchange emails, and al-Awlaki agrees, "Yes, I want to find a wife to live with me while I'm underground." And they literally post ads on Facebook looking for a woman to live underground with Anwar al-Awlaki. And they get responses from all over the world. And eventually this woman who was a Catholic from Croatia who had converted to Islam is chosen as the leading candidate to marry Anwar al-Awlaki. And she and al-Awlaki exchange a series of videos. And the videos are now available. And when one video she's wearing a cover and she's saying, you know, "In the next video I'll show you more of myself." And al-Awlaki is telling her about how it's going to be tough living life underground and you'll have limited access to toiletries and you have to be okay with living in tents. And they're going back and forth like this. The woman has no idea that she has anything to do with a CIA plot. And so this whole thing is being run by the CIA and this former bike gangster turned intelligence asset of the Danish intelligence service. So they eventually purchase luggage for Amina, the CIA does, that they then install tracking devices on. And the idea is that Amina is going to go to Yemen with her Louis Vuitton CIA luggage, is somehow going to, you know, find Anwar al-Awlaki, thinking she's going to marry him, and the CIA is going to kill both of them in a drone strike. That was the plan. So she flies to Sana'a. Awlaki's people come and meet her at the airport, and they smartly ditch the luggage and force her to change clothes, and she goes off with them and marries Anwar Awlaki and has a child with Anwar Awlaki. So I call it the CIA's dating service. And with that, I have the only humorous moment in my book. So Awlaki is living with his CIA-facilitated wife, who's come to join him in the front of jihad, and they have their baby, and they're living their life underground. And the CIA then approaches Anwar Awlaki's youngest brother, Ammar, who works for an oil company. And they approach him in Vienna, Austria, in a hotel, and offer him $5 million to give up his brother's location. And he says, I haven't seen my brother since 04. And they are putting this pressure on him. We'll go back and tell your family that there's a $5 million bounty on your brother's head, and that money could be used to raise Anwar's kids. And Ammar goes back, and his mother says, never speak to those people again. So the hunt is both military, and they're using intelligence tactics and trying to pay for intelligence about where Anwar Awlaki may be. In May, early May of 2011, Osama bin Laden is killed in Abbottabad, Pakistan, by a JSOC team that was being run in a CIA-led operation. And then the Obama administration wants to run the deck. They have a against al-Qaeda around the world. And they get a bead on Awlaki's location. And Awlaki's driving in a vehicle in about a week after the bin Laden strike. A number of drones and some Harrier jets go into Yemen's airspace. They try to kill Awlaki in the truck. A missile misfires. They try to kill him again. It misfires. There's a huge dust-up, smoke. Awlaki calls these two brothers, the Harad brothers, live nearby. They come in a truck to bail Awlaki out, and in the smoke, they switch vehicles. The two brothers get into Awlaki's vehicle. He gets into theirs. They split out in opposite directions. The war planners from the U.S. have only one missile left. They have to decide which car to hit. They hit the original vehicle and blow the two brothers up, and Awlaki watches his car explode from a nearby sort of cliff. He then goes to the home of another imam in Yemen and wrote an essay about surviving the strike that night, and he said 11 missiles missed their target tonight, but maybe the next one is going to hit. So in this period, as the hunt for Awlaki is intensifying, the drone strikes are happening in Yemen, the air war is intensifying, Awlaki's eldest son, who I mentioned earlier, Abdulrahman Awlaki, turns 16 years old. And he decides that he wants to go and try to find his father. Now, he had been being raised by his grandparents in Sana'a, and they had dreams of sending him to the United States. And I got to know his friends very well and his family, and did extensive interviews about who this kid was. He had nothing remotely to do with terrorism. He was a completely normal, goofy, adolescent kid who was into hip-hop music and comic books and was a warm, quiet elder brother to his siblings. This is relevant because of what would later happen to this young man. He runs away from home looking for his father at the very beginning of September 2011. He goes to Shebwa, the scene of repeated strikes aimed at killing his father. And his plan is to try to figure out a way to liaise with him. While he is in Shebwa, his father is killed in the north of Yemen, in Jauf. And Anwar Awlaki is killed with another American citizen named Samir Khan, who was an aspiring jihadist who is believed to have been the editor-in-chief of Inspire magazine, the magazine of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So these two American citizens are killed in a drone strike. The Awlaki kid is hundreds of kilometers away, trying to find his father when he's killed. When this strike happened, there were two reactions in Washington when these two American citizens, neither of whom had been charged with a crime, were killed. Silence or celebration? Hillary Clinton sounded like John McCain on that day. There was one Republican congressman said, well, if Samir Khan wasn't the target of that hit, then it was a bonus. It was a twofer, like a two for one. The only people who said anything about this in Washington, who seemed concerned that the constitutional law professor, Nobel Prize-winning president, had assassinated two U.S. citizens who hadn't been charged with a crime and weren't on an active battlefield shooting at U.S. soldiers, were Dennis Kucinich, who was a Democrat that has perennially, or every 4 years, seeks the Democratic nomination for president, and Ron Paul, who at the time was running an insurgent campaign for the Republican nomination for president and is a libertarian. Other than that, it was celebration or silence. 2 weeks later, Abdulrahman Awlaki is still stuck in Shebwa because of the uprising against the U.S.-backed dictatorship in Yemen as part of what's called the Arab Spring or the uprising. And he can't get back to Sana'a because the roads are blocked and there's fighting along the road. So he's basically hanging out with his family in this rural province. One night they go out for dinner, he and his cousin Ahmed, who is 17, and some other young people from the tribe, and they're sitting having dinner at about 9 o'clock at night in a makeshift outdoor restaurant when a drone appears above them and fires a missile and blows the kids up, and blows them to pieces. The next morning, Dr. Nasser al-Awlaki receives a phone call from his relatives in Shebwa saying that Abdulrahman has been killed in a drone strike with other members of our tribe. And they said, you know, we couldn't identify all of their bodies. We just found part of his head. And they knew it was his head because he had a distinct, massive head of hair. And he refused to get his hair cut despite his mother's protestation and his grandfather saying, you don't look dignified. But he had decided it was sort of his rebellious trademark, and he wanted to keep it. And they knew it was his head because they found this part of his skull and he had the huge hair on it. So the kid gets killed, and the family couldn't believe that this was a coincidence. It's so hard, if any of you think about it, the idea that you kill the father and then 2 weeks later you kill his son, the idea that that's a coincidence seems unfathomable. So they, like anyone would, start asking questions. How could this happen? And just as they start to think of, do we have lawyers in the United States reach out to the White House? What do we do? He's an American citizen, just as his father was, but no one said that this kid ever had anything to do with terrorism. In fact, the family says, we understand why the Americans wanted to kill Anwar. They believe that the U.S. exaggerated his role within al-Qaeda, but they understood because Anwar had crossed the line. He had declared war against the United States. They didn't support his killing, but they understood why the U.S. wanted him dead. With Abdulrahman, the 16-year-old kid, it made no sense. So just as they're about to start asking these questions, a U.S. military official leaks anonymously the allegation that the al-Awlaki kid was 21 years old and that he was at a meeting of al-Qaeda militants. So then the family produces his birth certificate from the state of Colorado showing definitively that the kid had just turned 16. And they said, well, he was nearby a meeting of al-Qaeda figures. And then they said, well, he was actually meeting with this guy, Ibrahim al-Bana, who is a propagandist for al-Qaeda. Well, it turns out that Ibrahim al-Bana is still alive. AQAP releases a statement saying this is all lies the Americans are trying to use to justify killing Abdulrahman al-Awlaki. Now, I don't know who was at that meeting. I don't know who Abdulrahman, beyond the family members that are dead. I don't know who else was in that restaurant. What I do know is that the Obama administration has never explained why they conducted an operation that was a targeted strike, not some tank firing rounds at a building and oops, we killed someone. It was a strike on that very place where the kid was. Why did that operation take place? What was the justification for it? You see, in the United States right now, we have a pattern where we litigate cases against potential criminals who are plotting terrorist attacks or not plotting terrorist attacks. We litigate it in media leaks from the White House. There's no court proceedings anymore for the vast majority of people targeted by the United States, including its own citizens. I've spent more than a year of my life trying to get an answer to why that kid was killed. And the most current information I have is that it was an outrageous mistake. That's the quote. It was an outrageous mistake. And I said to a former senior White House official, if it was an outrageous mistake, why don't you just say that to the American people in the world? Say we conducted this operation, this person was killed, and we're sorry that al-Awlaki's kid was there, but he shouldn't have been near this guy. Whatever line you want to say, why not just say it? And wrap this thing up so that it doesn't look like what you did is assassinate someone's kid because they had the wrong last name. And he said, look at it this way. And this is almost a verbatim quote. You can look it up because I put it in an article recently. He said, we had just killed 3 American citizens in a 2-week period. 2 of whom weren't even targets, Samir Khan and Abdulrahman al-Awlaki. It didn't look good. It was embarrassing. It was embarrassing. That's why there isn't an explanation, or why they won't provide their version of an explanation as to why they killed this 16-year-old U.S. kid. I find it impossible to believe that it was a coincidence. And I think that the answer to that question, why that kid was killed, says a lot about who we are, who I am as an American, what my society looks like and what it projects to the world. When the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, was asked about the killing of the 3 American citizens by Candy Crowley on CNN, he said, what I know is this. If there were 3 Americans that deserved to be killed, it was those 3 Americans. And I went after Harry Reid and tried to get him to explain why Abdulrahman al-Laki deserved to be killed. What evidence do you have that this 16-year-old was involved in anything except having the last name al-Laki that got him killed? Robert Gibbs, who was the former White House spokesperson, who understands the power of words when speaking to journalists, was serving as the senior surrogate for Obama's reelection campaign in 2012. Robert Gibbs was asked by a young reporter named Sierra Adamson, why did you kill Abdulrahman al-Laki, a 16-year-old who hadn't been charged with any crimes? You didn't give him due process. And Gibbs says he should have had a more responsible father. There are few crimes you can commit in history worse than blaming the killing of children on who their parents are. And that's exactly what Obama's chief spokesperson for his reelection campaign said. He's never recanted that statement. It's shameful. He should be ashamed of himself for having said that about the killing of a 16-year-old kid. So we have no answer on that. The state of oversight of the kill program in the United States right now is a couple of senators get to go into a padded room, a secure classified intelligence facility. They're not allowed to bring in writing utensils. They can't bring in paper. They can't bring in any recording devices, phones, cameras, nothing. And they can look at certain memos that the White House has authorized them to look at that explain the legal rationale for targeting U.S. and non-U.S. citizens in these kinds of strikes across the world. Nothing has ever been published to explain to the American people how you get on a kill list or how you get off a kill list. How would Anwar al-Awlaki have surrendered to a drone when he hadn't been charged with a crime? Who do you surrender to when there's no charges against you? None of those questions have been answered by the White House. As far as I'm concerned, there should be no difference between American and non-American lives. My life is not worth more than the life of a kid in Pakistan or Yemen or Somalia or Afghanistan. Not worth one penny more than any of their lives, particularly not in the bank of morality in the world. But why I think this case is so important and why we have to have an answer on how those three U.S. citizens were killed, under what authorities and justification, is because if the U.S. will treat its own citizens like that, you can imagine that the treatment of Afghans or Yemenis or Pakistanis or Somalis is going to be much worse, that the standards are going to be much lower. It says a lot about who we are as a society. So under this administration of Barack Obama, you have seen a legitimization of assassination as a central component of U.S. foreign policy and what's called U.S. national security policy. It's not that the U.S. hasn't been in the assassination game for a long time. It's that the technology of war is now far more advanced than it's ever been, with drone strikes and other, you call them unmanned, although pilots get mad at you or are sitting in the control boxes flying the drones. But you have never had a period where you have had an ability to strike without putting your own skin in the game on the scale that you have right now in the number of countries that you have outside of perhaps World War II with aerial bombardment. And even then you have the risk of pilots being shot down. But when the world is a battlefield and drones become the policy or cruise missile attacks become the policy, then there's other moral questions that need to be asked about it, about the nature of anything vaguely resembling a democratic process and the decision of whether or not to go to war. We're living in a moment where the popular democratic president is coming up with the disposition matrix, as they call it, an algorithm for determining who should be captured, who could be killed, who should we try harder on, who should we just put a hellfire into. You have Terror Tuesday meetings where committees meet to put candidates on lists of who's going to live and die around the world, and the president decides which baseball cards stay on the wall and which come off. The U.S. is backing warlords and gangsters in Somalia, outsourcing its kill program as it's been doing for years and years. Drone strikes intensified in Pakistan. Signature strikes have been used. I'm sure people have heard about this. It's the most grotesque form of pre-crime, like the movie Minority Report starring Tom Cruise, where the ball comes up and pops up a name and the crime they're going to commit, and you go and send the authorities to go and get them. In the regions of Pakistan and Yemen, we now say, well, if someone is of a military age and they're a male and they're with a group of other military-aged males, and someone there has been on the phone at some point with someone that we believe is a terrorist, we're just going to go ahead and say they're terrorists, and we will take them out preemptively for who they might one day become, for what they might one day do. It's the difference between that and pre-crime is that we're not even sure who these people are or that they will commit a crime. We're just saying that if they fit the pattern of people that we think are terrorists, we'll just kill them preemptively. Barack Obama has been responsible for killing a tremendous number of actually dangerous people who do plot to bring down airplanes. I don't know if Anwar al-Awlaki was involved with these plots. He may be guilty of every single thing that the White House and the Pentagon and the CIA accuse him of in their leaks. He may have been deeply responsible for the attempted underwear bomber or trying to buy ricin to poison American water supplies or attack public transportation systems. All of that may be true. But if it is true, why not indict him? Why not say, here's the evidence against him. We demand his extradition. And then if you can't get him extradited, I don't like it, but you can make an argument that you can go in there and snatch him, especially if he's engaged in plotting against the United States. None of that was done. Instead, he was sentenced to death by the constitutional law professor president without even being given a trial. The president served as judge, jury, and executioner, and they litigated the case through leaks. So when you have a situation where the world, I think, thought we were moving in a different direction after the 8 years of the Bush-Cheney era, where you have a popular Democrat who is normalizing these things, selling it to liberals, implying that it's a clean war, and you ignore the impact of your policies around the world, you are doomed to blowback. You are doomed to give people a legitimate reason to want to harm you. As an American, that's one of my biggest fears, is that what we are doing is creating a whole new generation of enemies who have legitimate scores to settle. This isn't about hating McDonald's or freedom. This is about settling scores of personal family members killed, of livelihoods destroyed, of villages hit with cluster bombs. I heard repeatedly in Yemen people saying something to the effect of, you say Al-Qaeda is terrorists, we say the drones are terrorism. And how could I argue with them and say, well, you're actually wrong because according to this definition of terrorism, they're... No, for them that is terrorism. And so when we, in the eyes of many in these countries, become the terrorists, we then are going to face a wrath from these people. It might not be in a year or two, but down the line, we're going to get hit for this too. It's all of our moral responsibility to address what these governments are doing. Britain is deeply complicit in all of this. Britain provides intelligence to the United States that's used to lethally target people around the world. I was talking with people from Reprieve and the Bureau for Investigative Journalism about this very issue. I hope it gets investigated thoroughly. What is the role of the British government in the ongoing American assassination program? What is the role of the British government in the ongoing rendition program or networks of secret prisons around the world? These are questions that people in Britain should be asking of their elected officials. My understanding is that there is potentially some serious lawbreaking that's gone on here. If some of what we hear from human rights organizations and lawyers investigating these cases is true, this should be a scandal in Britain as well. I want to end by saying this. In the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing, you know, I was watching the coverage of the SWAT teams descending on these neighborhoods in Boston and the outlying areas, and they're on this manhunt, and Rupert Murdoch, who I think some of you are well aware of, put the picture of this young kid on the front page of the New York Post, who was wearing a track outfit and he was carrying a gym bag. And they said, this is the bag man, the guy that the feds are looking for in connection with the bombing. Because he happened to be a brown Muslim looking, whatever that means, because there are white as white Muslims around the world, but he looked like a Muslim. So they put his face on the cover of the New York Post. And it turns out, so shockingly enough, that this high school track star actually was at the marathon that day to watch the marathon and not to plant a bomb. But they smear that guy, and they ruin that kid's life. They tarred him. There was a hunt for the kid. They find him. He was incredulous that they had pulled him in for it. There was so much hysteria. It reminded me of the post-9/11 atmosphere, where the hunt is on looking for the Al-Qaeda operatives in our midst. And always then you have these ricochet effect of hate crimes, and cab drivers are attacked, and businesses are vandalized. And that happened after Boston, and the media coverage was atrocious. But what was amazing, and I guarantee you that you saw it here on your news too, because when these things happen in America, it happens all over the world. We project it. We have 3 people killed in a bombing the same day that 27 people were killed in a Baghdad suicide bombing in a cafe, and that's not even an afterthought on the news ticker underneath the images of the hunt for the Boston Marathon bomber. And you saw the coverage of there was an 8-year-old boy who was killed in that blast. And he had painted this gorgeous picture, this peace symbol, and that went viral on Facebook. And And we knew the story of the first responders like Carlos Arredondo, this guy whose son was killed in Iraq fighting with the U.S. military. He was a U.S. soldier who was killed in Iraq. And Carlos Arredondo has dedicated his life to being a peace activist. And he was at the marathon that day raising funds for wounded veterans. And he ran toward the blast when it went off. And there's an iconic photo of him in a cowboy hat carrying away a double amputee, a guy who both of his legs had been blown off. And Carlos Arredondo is there carrying the wheelchair away. And they had tied a cloth around the guy's leg to try to stop the bleeding. And we heard the stories of heroism and bravery from people. And we heard the stories of the lives taken, just as we did when our elementary schools get shot up. New York Times put all of the names and ages of those kids, and it was horrifying reading it. You imagine your own kid, you know, Sally Jones, 5, Billy Smith, 6, you know, all the, you have it going, it guts you because you relate to them and you say, those are our people. And that's when journalists are at their best in America, when they're telling the stories that are meant to be based on empathy, a sense that this is happening to all of us. And, you know, one of the victims of the Boston Marathon bombing was a Chinese woman who was a graduate student. And the President of the United States said her name. And a blog post went viral in China after that. And the title of the blog post was "Where You Die Matters." And the point that it was making is that that woman's name never would have been said by the most powerful man in the world if she had died in a factory in China making a product for Western consumers. But because she died there, her life and her death matter. We know what she wanted to do with the rest of her life because where she died mattered. 10 years ago, I probably would have said that I had all sorts of answers as to how we confront this or how we change this. But I'm not so arrogant as to come in front of you and say, this is all we need to do and we're gonna win. And if we just do this and call this Congress member and write this letter and sign this petition, because it's far more complicated than that. I actually think that part of our job, not just as journalists, but all of us, is to internalize the stories of someone who's had their life impacted by the policies of our governments. To internalize that so that the next time someone says, this person was killed as collateral damage, that you actually have a real story that you can tell about collateral damage, about someone who's been killed in that manner. I've internalized the story of Abdulrahman Al-Laki because I want to know why that kid was killed. It's not because I think he's any more important than anyone else killed in a drone strike. It's because it has to be real or else all you're doing is whistling past a graveyard somewhere. You're not actually taking it seriously. The reason we care about incidents that happen in our community is because we see it as happening to us. Or we can empathize with the parents grieving over their kid getting shot by a maniac in an American school. We should have that same empathy for people who live on the other side of our missiles. We should take their stories as our own before we start formulating opinions about what we think the best way to fight terrorism is, because there is a moral dimension to it. I also believe that strategically, you can argue that we're making our nations less safe, not more safe, with our current counterterrorism policies. But I also think if we erase the idea that morality should ultimately govern what we think is right and wrong in the world, then we stop actually being human beings. So that's the only challenge that I really want to leave people with. Is to put some of your own skin in the game. Don't be a moralless drone pilot who sits in a box somewhere and decides that they're going to bomb someone halfway across the world and then get into their car and drive off the base past a sign that says, "Buckle up, this is the most dangerous part of your day." Meaning you can get into a traffic accident after bombing Yemen or Pakistan and that's the greatest threat that you're going to face in your life. Unless you have some moral skin in the game, you're just like the guy sitting in the box bombing another country. It's just on a different plane. So on that uplifting note, I do want to thank everyone for coming out tonight and happy to discuss with you any of this, answer any questions, and real honor to be with you. Thank you.
I think we'll take a few questions now. First question.
Okay. I've been demonstrating today in Parliament Square about Shaka Armour, who's in Guantanamo. He's been there 11 years. Charity worker, everybody knows that. He's been cleared 6 years ago and told he could come home. And there are about 100 similar cases in Guantanamo at the present time on hunger strike. We don't know what the hell's going on. There's no reason that we can understand why he shouldn't be back here in Battersea, where he belongs, where his wife is and children. But why don't you tell us something about Guantanamo so that we can help to understand it better?
Were you not here at the beginning? I mean, I was talking about Guantanamo at the very beginning. Okay,
why are you still there? Do you know? Do you have any idea? We don't.
Okay, first of all, I don't represent the U.S. government. But secondly, I think that, I mean, I'm with you, my man. Amen. I mean, it's, look, here's part of the issue. When Obama said that he was going to close Guantanamo and it was campaigning on that, I think he had no concept of what he was going to face and no concept of how obstructionist the Republicans would be on the one hand and how much actual fight it would have required on his part. I think that there's a reason. The only reason why Guantanamo is still open is because Obama didn't fight hard enough. When he wants to kneecap the Republicans or members of his own party to get them to do something, he's quite effective at doing it. He did not give up that. He did not put up that fight with Guantanamo. Everyone that was working on the Guantanamo issue for the first year of his administration was either quietly forced out or they quietly departed office. The Republicans have blocked the funding required to close Guantanamo, and that's what the White House likes to talk about. It's an absolute stain on the United States' image around the world, and I think on anything resembling a democratic process that prison camp remains open. And I think it's for crass political reasons why that prison is not closed. It absolutely should be shut down. People that have been cleared for release should be allowed to return to wherever it is they want to go. And those that have not been cleared for release, you either give them a trial, a fair trial, and bring some actual evidence against them, or you release them. But at this point, after holding some people 10 years or more, I mean, or more? Yeah, that's this is we're at the Oxford Union, and we're going to debate what we agree about more passionately with each other. Anyway, thank you for your question. And anyone else? Well, hold on. Let someone else speak if they want to. Yeah. Go ahead, back there.
Well, thank you very much for your presentation. Could you actually elaborate on what you believe these crass political reasons to be, or what you think the most crass of them is? For example, the countries where these prisoners are proposed to be returned, refusing to accept them, or something else?
Well, I mean, that's a small part of it, and that's something often that the White House is on their talking points. Oh, well, we don't have, you know, certain countries won't take them. We don't have a place to put them. You know, Yemen has repeatedly asked for the ability to take back the prisoners. And in fact, they asked that the United States help fund a rehabilitation center similar to the one in Saudi. And the U.S. has refused to give the funds. And now politically, I think, has made a decision that it's not going to, at least for the time being, not going to allow Yemen to do that. The political aspect of it is that I think that the Obama administration is terrified that they'll release Guantanamo prisoners and they're going to be involved with some kind of plot against the United States, and that the Republicans or the people that are advocating for Guantanamo to remain open would be vindicated in that process. But I generally just think that it's an issue that Obama is going to try to sweat out until his administration is done and then leave it for the next person to deal with. He claimed a couple of weeks ago that he was going to renew the fight to close Guantanamo, but it would really require him making it a central priority of his administration, because he'll have to play the political threat game, particularly with the Republicans, and I don't know that he wants to spend political capital on it, which is why I think it's crass. I think that has nothing to do with what their rights are or what's actually right. It has more to do with political efficacy or efficiency and what he wants to actually spend his capital on in Washington. So, I mean, I think it's shameful. It's utterly shameful that you have a man that campaigned on that and actually is a constitutional law expert who has said that it's an unlawful process, that he would allow it to fester on like that and not put everything he can toward fighting it, I think speaks volumes to the state of affairs in Washington.
Thank you for such a deeply impassioned, devastatingly detailed, depressing, anger-inducing account.
You're the Dr. Seuss of anti-war activism.
Well, thank you.
Sorry.
Kissinger said, it's an act of insanity and national humiliation not to have a law, or to have a law preventing the president from ordering assassination. The constitutional law professor declared Gandhi, Dr. King fan, sent 30,000 troops to Afghanistan. There's the weekly kill list. Are you able to give a rough guess as to his body count thus far? That's question A. And B, now that he is transmogrified into a kind of Kissinger, though unacknowledged in the press, where does that leave the millions of right-thinking Americans who put him where he is?
Well, first of all, one thing I just want to respond to is a minor point that you made, but for me, I think it's an important one for people to understand. There is no law in the United States prohibiting assassination, and there's a reason why there's no law. What there is an executive order that has been on the books since the Ford administration. It's actually sort of an interesting sub-conversation of this. So the reason that there isn't a law is because Congress wouldn't touch it with, 100 miles away, because they don't want to define what an assassination is, because of a belief that it would undermine the ability of the United States to conduct wars that Democrats and Republicans conduct and call them something else. You know, President Clinton tried to assassinate Saddam Hussein in multiple airstrikes throughout the course of his time in office. You know, Reagan tried to kill Muammar Gaddafi. They had executive orders on the books. Part of the reason why this continues is that it allows Congress to sort of get away with not having to confront the issue of defining assassination, because the U.S. has engaged in assassination for a very long time. I have no idea about the body count under President Obama. You know, Lindsey Graham, this Republican senator, let slip during a hearing recently that there was an estimate of 4,700 people killed in drone strikes, and then he tried to back it up and say, oh, he had just read it somewhere and that it wasn't based on classified intelligence. I think it's impossible to count how many people have been killed. I've harped a lot tonight, and I generally try not to do this, on the issue of drones, because I think drones are a small part of the issue. What I'm actually more concerned about going forward is the relationship between U.S. forces and other militaries, propping up human rights abusing forces, working with mercenary forces, working with opposition forces in countries like Syria or Libya, and what kinds of human rights records do those forces have? I would draw a little bit of a distinction between Obama and Kissinger, if I may. You know, I think of someone like Dick Cheney as truly the caricature that's been presented. I mean, I think of him as Darth Vader in his lair, plotting how to destroy the world and get Halliburton stock to go up. I mean, that's maybe a bit further than I think, but I think he's generally that kind of a character. I think that Obama genuinely has bought into his own rhetoric about this, that he believes that what he's doing is keeping the United States safe. I don't think that there's some political conspiracy that, Obama has sort of decided to just let the generals do this. I think that he actually has bought into it, which in a way makes it a bit more, even more frightening, because he seemed like at a different point in life, there was a different sensibility about him. But I do think that you can never be the American president unless you subscribe passionately to American exceptionalism. And the idea that that things like world courts and international criminal courts are for other people, for the Milosevic's of the world, and not for the civilized leaders of the free world. At one point when Clinton was looking at maybe ratifying the International Criminal Court, there were lawmakers in the U.S. that wanted to put forward a bill that they were calling the Hague Invasion Act that would have authorized U.S. military forces to go into The Hague to liberate any U.S. personnel that would have been brought up on war crimes charges. But America needs both the Kissingers and the Carters or the Obamas to continue to function. I mean, look at the extraordinary service Obama has provided for the most hawkish wing of the Republican Party. The next time there's a Republican in office, whether it's a Marco Rubio or a Jeb Bush, and they want to take this a bit further, liberals aren't going to have much of a leg to stand on. What's their answer going to be? Oh, well, it was just smarter when Obama was doing it. No, that doesn't work. The Republicans somewhere are very, very happy that this has happened, because they're long-term strategic thinkers. Look at the debates between Romney, not that I would ever want you to be punished enough to watch these, but what were called debates between Romney and Obama. On foreign policy, Obama would describe all the terrorists that he's killed, how we've made America safer, how our might is great. And then Romney would say, well, actually, I agree with President Obama, but I agree with him more than he agrees with him. And that was the extent of the foreign policy debate. But you need the Democrats will come in and clean things up for the base, and then it sort of hits the reset button the next time the Republicans come into office. So, yeah. Good thing it's really cool in here tonight, you know.
The first thing I want to say is to thank you for all your work. I have to say that what the sort of work that you, people like you and Glenn Greenwald, for example, do is incredibly important in terms of developing the campaigns to actually fight against what you're saying. The question I wanted to put was related to what you think the awareness is, the growing awareness is in America of what's being done in their name. In Britain last month, we had the first national demonstration against drones in Britain. And we were really surprised because we had huge media coverage. I mean, for that day, it was the main item on the news. And I'm in the organisation Stop War Coalition, and the people who organised that demonstration that day were organisations like War and Want and CND and others. And we've got the feeling that there's the beginnings of a sea change in terms of people's awareness, because clearly what the policy at the moment is to fight. Wars are not popular. If you look at all of the opinion polls over the last decade, almost continuously, you've had high majorities, both in this country and in Britain, that oppose the wars. So this strategy whereby these wars are fought in secret behind our backs obviously is very attractive. Do you feel that in the States, like here, there's the beginnings of a growing awareness of what's being done in the public's name? I mean, to finish, the organisation I'm with, Stop the War Coalition, we're in daily contact with an American activist who you will know, David Swanson. And he sends us reports every day of local things that are going on and developing in the States. And the same's happening here. And I just wanted to see what your reflection is on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there, you know, part of the issue in the U.S. is that this story is not really covered on large media outlets, and it's really quite astonishing that it doesn't receive more debate. In the past year, there has been more discussion on this on large media outlets than there has been in the previous 10 years combined, just on the issue of sort of drones and the assassination program, although it's never called an assassination program. It's targeted killing, which if you think about it, is sort of a bizarre term anyway, and I'm guilty of using it myself, but one thing that has happened is that the Tea Party, and I think this is the bizarre nature of American politics, the Tea Party, because the scary black man is president, have decided that drones are a threat. They're thinking of the idea that in Montana, in the state of Montana, that someone who's publishing their militia zine about storing up their supplies for the coming Black Hawk helicopters of the UN, that scary black anti-colonialist Kenyan socialist Barack Obama is going to drone strike them in a cafe in Montana to prevent them from putting out their revolutionary zine about the Black Hawk helicopters from the UN coming to take over and declare the Kofi Annan Republic of Montana. And but not to sort of dismiss them entirely, their opposition to this has caused even Sarah Palin to come out and in a stance against drones, which is sort of fantastic on one level. The most famous anti-drone action in U.S. history was from a Tea Party senator named Rand Paul, who's the son of Ron Paul, and he's now a senator, and is absolutely bananas crazy on 99% of issues. On this one issue, he actually managed to say to engage in the most sane 3 hours of discussion on the Senate floor when he attempted to filibuster the nomination of John Brennan as CIA director. Now, that went on for over 12 hours, and you notice I said 3 hours, because 3 hours of it were sane, and the other nine was just an insane carnival of bizarre potential threats, like I mentioned. One including, would Jane Fonda have been drone struck by Obama for sitting on a North Vietnamese tank or whatever, at a different point in history? But it raised awareness. And I think it was, even though it came from a really unfortunate source, it cracked the door open and caused a discussion in the larger U.S. media that had been lacking for so long. But in order for it to actually change, you would have to have responsible, credible lawmakers in the U.S. ask the right questions. And at this point, I can count on my hand the number of senators or or representatives that have ever asked a real good question. We had two hearings in the past month in the U.S. Senate about drones and about this kill policy in general. And in one of them, this young Yemeni guy named Fareh al-Muslimi testified in front of the U.S. Senate. And I know Fareh. I had met him in Yemen, and he's a very wonderful, amazing, smart young guy whose family's ancestral village was bombed 6 days before he testified in the U.S. It was hit in a U.S. drone strike, and he had live-tweeted the text messages from his family members. And so he's testifying, and he gives this gut-wrenching testimony about how this is actually making more enemies for the United States, and said it was sort of kerosene on the fire. And no one asked him a question, a real question. They had three boring academics who lived down the street from the Capitol, who they could get any day of the week, and they spent the majority of their hearing talking theoretical warfare with academics who are deeply embedded in the dangerous world of the chairs in front of their desks. And they had a guy from Yemen who actually had real-world experience and asked him nothing. Al Franken, who some of you may know as a comedian, remains a comedian as a lawmaker because he's subscribed to the idea, instead of the president deciding who should be killed in the drone strike, we should set up courts for this so that the courts can decide who gets killed in a drone strike. I mean, that's the extent of the debate on Capitol Hill. Should the president do it in secret, or should we have secret courts that decide who lives and dies around the world? So, I mean, I'm very pessimistic about our ability to impact this discussion right now, particularly because the Obama era has solidified it. But there are cracks in the armor, I'll give you that. And it is, we're at the start of something that if enough public awareness is raised on it, there could be an actual dialogue. The final thing I'll say on it is that the drone issue to me is a very important issue, but if we just focus on it, it's like saying that we live in a world where there's only Kleenex and don't realize that Kleenex is actually a brand name. There's a ton of facial tissue. There's a lot of facial tissue in the targeted killing or the assassination business, and drones are just one branded part of it. In fact, one of the lesser lethal parts of it when you look at some of the other platforms, including night raids, cruise missile attacks, cluster bombs, conventional air bombing, supporting ruthless, thuggish, human rights abusing forces. So the drone issue is, I think, a good one because it's sexy and gets attention. But if you don't take on the basis of the program, the notion that the world is a battlefield, that the United States has a right to conduct these operations at will, most of the rest of the world does not view this as legitimate. And so unless Americans sort of back away from a nationalistic interpretation of their role in the world, then I think very little will change. You'll just continue to have these empowered executive branches in the United States that assert the right to do these things.
Thanks. Two things, if I may. Firstly, do you think one of the problems with shutting down Guantanamo and prosecuting people, and I don't mean this in a good way, is because you Americans have a quite vigorous court system and some quite vigorous lawyers. Yeah. And if people had been held in Guantanamo were actually in that system, then what had happened to them would be brought out, which would cause huge difficulties.
Yeah.
Because I think it's right, American citizens aren't sent to Guantanamo. And if you look at the experience of trying to prosecute American jihadis captured and brought home, I think John Walker Lind is one of them. Mm-hmm. He was given the mother of all plea bargains, and the word was, because the alternative would be to have a trial where he would say what had been done to him after his capture.
Absolutely.
And the other question is, having read, I'm about halfway through your book, in fact, I'm sure it's your journalistic brilliance that gets people to tell you what's gone on in very private and secret meetings, but there's an awful lot of things you write about, which are discussions which have taken place, presumably, which are meant to be confidential. Is that in part because even some people within the military system are getting worried and fed up with what's happening in their name?
Yeah, I mean, you made a number of points that I think are fantastic, and I'm glad that you raised them. But John Walker Lind is an interesting case. I mean, I think he was given 20 or 25 years in prison as part of his plea bargain. And for people that don't remember, he's known as the American Taliban. He was this young guy from the United States who had converted to Islam and went to Pakistan and ultimately to Afghanistan and then was captured in Afghanistan and was brought back to the United States and was given access to the civilian justice system and would have had a trial if he wanted one, but he ultimately took a plea bargain, and so he's serving his prison sentence. I do think that that's part of why Guantanamo remains open, because you have people that if they were given access to the U.S. court system, it's not just that they might get acquitted. Or that they might get lower sentences. I actually think many of those people, they would have tried to sentence to life in prison anyway and put them in these things called communication management units where you have almost no access to the outside world. There's almost no Muslims have ever been put into those prisons in the United States. They're largely reserved for Muslim prisoners, which is a whole other stain on the Republic. You know, they finally put a white environmental activist in one of these prisons so that they could say it's not just for Muslims. And he got out before anyone else. But I think part of it is that there are legal organizations in the United States that would rightly put that entire system on trial. Do you realize what would come up in these court cases? The extent of the torture tactics used against these guys. There are people in Guantanamo who went to 6 or 7 different secret prisons around the world, maybe more. We don't know all of the stories, and had unconscionable things done to them. Were stuffed into boxes, and then caterpillars would be put in, but they would say that they're tarantulas, and they would leave them in there with this thing crawling around. Can you imagine what that? To me, I would rather get waterboarded than stuck into a box with some kind of an insect that I think is a lethal. Can you imagine what that would do? Just to give one example, the ramming of heads against walls, the constant sleep deprivation, you don't know what's up or down, all of those things. And then and other stuff that I care not to talk about, shoving hoses into rectums and turning hoses on at full blast. I mean, these things were done by American personnel to people that they captured, many of whom probably had nothing to do with terrorism. You want that coming out in U.S. courts, lawyered up with the American Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Constitutional Rights? It could crack. It would crack that system. I mean, it would be horrifying, I think, to the U.S. government, the idea that the full extent of what was done in the name of American national security to other human beings, for that to be put out in the public domain, I think is a horror too hard to imagine. So what does Obama do with this? He doesn't want to give them access to the courts and have it be fought in that way. He doesn't want to send them back with the potential for some of them to get involved with attacks against the United States. He lets the thing fester. And I really think that is a huge part of it. It might sound cynical. I think that's a huge part of this. They don't want anyone to ever appear in court that's been through that torture system. I also think it's part of the reason why assassination has become the favorite option over capture. What's Obama going to do if he captures Anwar al-Awlaki? You want to put Anwar al-Awlaki in a civilian trial with lawyers? Oh, he would have gotten lawyers. I probably know who his lawyers would have been. And they would have been fantastic lawyers. And al-Awlaki could have made, he probably would have gone down eventually, I think. But he could have made quite a spectacle of that trial. And he could have put all of American foreign policy on trial. And the U.S. would have made a martyr. Much easier to just bump those people off. Every time Obama tries to prosecute someone in the civilian court system on terrorism charges, the Republicans and some Democrats go nuts. Treat them as enemy combatants. Don't give them their Miranda rights. These guys wanted this kid, Jahar Tsarnaev, you know, who was maybe involved with the Boston bombing. We don't know all the evidence yet. I don't like to convict people in the media, but they wanted him sent to Guantanamo. He's an American citizen. I mean, there were actual calls. The president is saying, I want Guantanamo closed. The Republicans are saying, put more people in Guantanamo. So it's really, you know, kind of incredible that this goes on. But I think that you're getting at something, which is that there is a case to be made that when you give people access to the justice system, you have to respect the outcome. And for 10 years, we've been tilting the deck against anyone that we claim is a terrorist. We haven't had to actually test the veracity of our own system because we don't give people access to our system. We hold them in an offshore gulag.
One more question.
I really resonate with your theme about it tells us about what kind of people we are in terms of what we're willing to tolerate in terms of high crime by our governments. And it seems it's all required of us is to avert our gaze and a default prejudicial prejudices. It seems that Bradley Manning just refused to do that, to avert his gaze while deployed in Baghdad. We're on the cusp of his court-martial. Julian Assange is surrounded by London Metropolitan Police at expense of over £3 million thus far. I'm just wondering, as an anti-war activist, how can you explain millions of people marched against this war in Iraq and two men who are involved in exposing the nature of it look pretty isolated as Bradley goes to trial?
Yeah. Well, two things on that, I would say. One, on the issue of Bradley Manning, I never until recently made any comments about Bradley Manning because in general, I'm so against the way that we are prosecuting people that the United States government alleges are involved with criminal activity before any evidence has been presented against them, or before, in the case of Bradley Manning, he admitted that he provided the cables. Now we know that he has openly said in court, because the audio recording of it leaked out. If you listen to the audio recording of Bradley Manning, this is a guy who clearly was motivated by a deep sense that what he was involved with as a member of the U.S. military was wrong, that he did this out of a sense of conscience. They've attempted to smear him. Oh, he's a transvestite. You know, he's Brad ass. You know, they've tried to harp on his sexuality, that he was a confused guy in the world. They've tried to make him sound like a degenerate, knowing that there's a very conservative Christian aspect to all of American society. They tried to play to the sort of fears, oh, this is someone who is a deranged cross-dresser. Bradley Manning, if you listen to that, was calm, articulate, and deliberate in describing why he leaked those cables. He knew what he was doing when he did it. He knew it was a crime. He probably knew a crime according to the rules governing his life as a soldier. He probably knew he would ultimately get caught someday, but chose to do it. The fact that they haven't broken him, that they haven't gotten him to sort of recant or take a lesser sentence, and the fact that he stood up and said, I did all of these things, says something extraordinary about who he is. You know, I didn't know this, but Bradley Manning had emailed me just before he released the collateral murder video, as it was called, of the helicopter attack in Baghdad. And I didn't find out about it until well after Bradley Manning was an internationally known figure. Someone had called me up who was working on a story about Bradley Manning and said, I'm interviewing people that communicated with Bradley Manning. And I said, well, I'd never communicated with Bradley Manning. And he said, oh, I've been told that you had been in touch with Bradley Manning. I said, I've never been in touch with Bradley. I think I would remember being in touch with Bradley Manning. And he's like, okay, well, I guess I've been misinformed. And then a couple of days later, he calls me on the phone and he says, look, I don't want to bother you, but can you just do me a favor? Just search this email in your inbox. So I search it and up pops this email and I look at it and it's Bradley Manning. And I said to this guy who called me, I said, I'm not going to confirm or deny that I got any email from Bradley Manning. And the reason that I didn't do that at the time is because what Bradley Manning had written me about was he wrote me to say, he didn't give me any classified information. He didn't give me any information that was based on his life as a soldier. He had a bizarre personal connection to someone attached to the Blackwater story. And he told me, I know someone in my personal capacity who has information about the travel plans of Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater. And my understanding is that Eric Prince is preparing to flee the United States and go to the United Arab Emirates. And at that time, Blackwater was under investigation by multiple agencies in the U.S. Ultimately, 5 Blackwater executives were indicted on weapons and conspiracy charges. And through Bradley Manning, I was able to get a source that confirmed that this guy was leaving the country. And so then I did a story about it, and then the New York Times ultimately published a story about it. And sure enough, Eric Prince lives in Abu Dhabi. And I found out about it because Bradley Manning had tipped me off to it. I decided to confirm that or to tell that story because the email that he sent me, which was a personal email, was clearly sent by someone who was deeply offended by the idea that someone that had whose company had been involved with killing Iraqi civilians was somehow going to get away. And that was the tone of the email that he sent me. And I feel like it's important to say that because I think he's been smeared. And he's going to face the consequences. And Bradley Manning is going to spend a long time in jail, I think, for what he did. And I think it's reprehensible that there are only 3 journalists covering that trial. And none of them work for a major news organization. The New York Times had to be shamed into covering that trial, despite the fact that they sold a hell of a lot of newspapers based on the cables that Bradley Manning had actually leaked. So to me, you know, it is Bradley Manning knew what he was getting into. He did it based on conscience, and his story deserves to be told, and he deserves to be treated as the serious person that he is and that he was when he took that action. As for the broader question that you asked, in the military, they like to talk about the long war. You know, and when they talk about terrorism, they like to talk about the long war and strategic thinking. I think all of us, whatever our role is, for whatever reason any of you are here tonight, whether you're studying this issue and disappointed in the speech that I gave, or you came here because you wanted to sort of have a deeper understanding, make sense of the activism that you're involved with, we all have to sort of take a humility pill and realize that in the years that have passed since the multi-million person marches around the world, I was in Baghdad when those took place, that in the years that have passed, there's been a decimation of many anti-war groups. There, in the U.S., it's been co-opted by the Democratic Party and largely silenced. But also there's a far more sort of human reality at play. People are tired. They're struggling economically around the world. In the United States, the banks and crooked corporations pilfered public finances. People are struggling. It's a hard ask for a woman who's raising three kids on her own and working a couple of jobs and maybe trying to go to night school to say, well, why don't you care about a drone victim in Yemen? It's a tough ask. So I think all of us, I think, have an obligation to look within our own community to try to see where the struggles are locally and always be attaching them to what's happening around the world. But just as the technology of warfare is advancing, there's very little new in war except the technology. We just play out the same cycles over and over again. We have to think outside of the box. We have to wage our own hearts and minds campaign if we actually believe in it. And that requires a new sort of strategic thinking. So I think we're at the beginning of a conversation. We're always at the beginning of a conversation, but we're at the beginning of a conversation now on how we address a world where the sort of leader of the most powerful country in the world has legitimized many of these things and ensured that they're going to, at least for the next couple of administrations, be staples of American foreign policy, which the rest of the world has to deal with on a daily basis. So, I mean, I'm all about being humble enough to realize that we're sort of starting over right now and trying to see how we forge ahead. I'm happy to hang around and chat with people, or if you have a book, I'd be happy to sign it. But I really just thank you for sitting in this sweltering hot room tonight, and thank you for your patience and for your time. Thank you.